Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of February. Our guest this hour is the author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. Shankar Vedantam is our guest, and Mr. Vedantam is a national correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post and also a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. And we're going to be welcoming phone calls. It's very interesting. He talks about the hidden brain as his term for everything that our minds do that lies outside the boundaries of our conscious awareness. Some aspects of the hidden brain are accessible via conscious effort, and others can be observed through experiments and tests. But on a moment-to-moment basis, we are not aware of most of what the hidden brain is up to, even as it influences us in profound ways, whether it be our ability to respond appropriately to warnings of impending disaster or our ability to make accurate judgments about a presidential candidate. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you're joining us in Milwaukee, or if you're joining us via email, that email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Shankar, thank you very much for being with us this hour. It should be an interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathleen. Yeah. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you start your book, the intro, you're being assigned to track Ralph Nader, and we don't have Ralph on the air very often, but he was our guest the first hour of the program,
which was pretty
strange. So what is Ralph Nader? How did that get you thinking about the hidden brain? What's the association?
There was actually no association between Ralph Nader and the hidden brain. It was entirely coincidental. I was assigned by the Washington Post to track Ralph Nader's presidential bid in 2004 in New England. And when I got to New England, I found the campaign was going absolutely nowhere, and many of Mr. Nader's own supporters, mindful of what had happened in the 2000 race between Al Gore and George W. Bush, had said they were planning to vote against him. And so I took a break from the political story and went to Harvard University to interview a psychologist who studied unconscious prejudice. And that was my first taste of this very, very fascinating world that lies within our heads, a world of unconscious influences which has profound effects on what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about the hidden brain, is it really, can you locate it in our brains? Is it some part of the brain?
No, the hidden brain is not meant to be taken literally. It's a metaphor for everything that our brains do without our awareness. The analogy I would have is to Richard Dawkins's The Selfish Gene. It's not as if our genes actually have are motivated by feelings of selfishness, and it's not as if the brain is physically hidden. What I'm really talking about is a host of influences that we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm. But there are mental disorders that can have a profound influence on the hidden brain?
Indeed. One of the things that I show in the book is much of the book talks about the downsides of the hidden brain, the ways in which unconscious bias adversely influences us, causes us to act against our better judgments and our best intentions. And one of the things that I think people would take away from that is this idea that if we were to do away with the hidden brain altogether, we would function much better. And unfortunately, this is not the case, because in much of our lives, the hidden brain also plays an enormously positive role. And in one of the chapters of my book, I discuss what might happen were a person to actually lose, physically lose, aspects of unconscious brain functioning. And I show that this would result not in us becoming supercomputing and accurate machines, but rather that it would result in very profound deficits, often in the realms that make us the most human.
Mm-hmm. And tell one of those stories, because there are fascinating stories in this book. The woman from Toronto, who by all appearances was quite normal, and then something happens to her. She has a hysterectomy, but it's not these are not related. And for whatever reason, she has this frontotemporal dementia, and she loses the very thing that you're talking about, and it results in incredibly bizarre behavior.
That's right. This is a story about a woman called Wendy McNamara, who lives right outside Toronto in Canada. Much of the book is based on rigorous and peer-reviewed scientific studies, but the book is not told as a series of science studies. It's told as narratives through the lives of people whose real lives illustrate what the scientific experiments are finding. Wendy and her husband Brian, had a very long and successful marriage, and then she had a hysterectomy, as you mentioned. And some weeks and months later, her husband started to notice that that Wendy was acting very distant. That she would she wouldn't respond. She seemed indifferent to many things. They would she would stop wanting to do things together. She was no longer feeling. She would no longer express affection or intimacy with Brian. And he couldn't quite figure out what was happening. It felt as if his marriage was falling apart, but he couldn't quite put a finger on anything because nothing explicitly was wrong. And over the course of the subsequent months, the odd events, and a series of odd events began to appear. Wendy would walk around the house in the middle of the night, and she would run her fingers over her china collection, in the middle of the night, or stand over the bed where Brian was sleeping and just watch him for hours at a time. When she was out in the world with strangers, she would walk up to strange people and ask to examine the soles of their shoes or to touch the faces of men with beards because she loved the sensation of anything that was crinkly or uneven. She was drawn to patterns of all kinds, and she would when she would drive in a car, for example, she would try and count the number of dead trees she could see passing on the highway. And Brian couldn't quite figure out what was happening. Wendy had been his high school sweetheart, and they went back many, many decades and had a wonderful marriage. But these strange events continued to multiply. Wendy behaved in extremely socially inappropriate ways. She drank to excess. She took advantage of their friends and did things that were really problematic. And at one point, Brian sort of said, we're really getting to the point of divorce here because it's just untenable to go on. And then friends of theirs recommended that they go in and get a series of examinations. And it was finally when they went to a neurologist that the neurologist conducted a series of tests and found that Wendy was suffering from a disorder known as frontotemporal dementia. And it's a curious disorder because it affects a part of our brains that we're not aware of most of the time. It's a part of our brains that regulates our social functioning, how we relate to other people. And the odd thing about the frontotemporal dementia is that when this part of the brain is impaired, not only does it affect our ability to relate to other people, but it affects our ability to make a whole host of judgments that we would normally think have nothing to do with social relationships. So it affects our ability to act in, it affects our table manners, it affects the way we make moral judgments, it affects the way we act ethically or whether we, how far we, where we see the line between ourselves and other people. In many ways, the McNamaras shared their story with me because Brian McNamara was very concerned that there are many patients with frontotemporal dementia who go undiagnosed, and as a result, they lose their marriages, they lose their livelihoods and their jobs and their friends, and they become homeless, all as a result of this neurological problem.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to fix it?
There is no way to fix or to cure frontotemporal dementia, but there are ways to manage it. One of the things that Brian has done is he now proactively goes out and explains to neighbors why it is that Wendy may show up at their houses unannounced, that she doesn't quite have the sense anymore about where social boundaries lie, about what the line is between appropriate and inappropriate behavior, or even ethical and unethical behavior. The McNamaras are very fortunate to be surrounded by neighbors who are kind and understanding, and Wendy is enrolled in a program where she's trying to relearn some of the social skills that her neurological disorder has taken from her.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes, and let's take on the issue of race here, because that chapter is really fascinating. Sometimes it's not a disease here. It's something else that I'm trying to get a handle on what this is. When you look at this issue of race, you cite a lot of studies about white people being thought of as the most honest, the most honorable, when lots of studies have been done among very, very young people as to who they would most trust, and it turns out to be white people, and you look at this issue of race. Mm-hmm. You're not really, let's talk about that in more detail, but you're not really looking at an underlying disease when you look at that issue, are you?
No, not at all. What I try and show with the chapter on the neurological disease is I'm really trying to show that you can document the existence of the hidden brain very clearly by showing people what happens to people who lose aspects of their hidden brain. So most of us think that our morality is conscious. Our sense of being honest people comes from conscious intention. And what the example of Wendy McNamara shows is that without, you know, people's conscious intentions changing in the least, their behavior can change in profound ways and often, you know, result in unethical behavior. And it's a contention of my book that the same thing applies to a number of other behaviors that have nothing to do with mental disorders, and prejudice certainly is one of them. Most of us think of racial prejudice as being conscious and deliberate animosity or hatred toward people from other groups. One of the chapters in my book looks at research conducted among very young children, children as young as three, who are already documenting an ability to categorize the world according to race and link positive or negative adjectives with white faces rather than black faces. And what I try and argue in the book is that this is not the result of conscious indoctrination by their parents or teachers. In fact, the parents and teachers of these children are extremely concerned that their children will develop intolerant views, and so they never bring up the question of race. They never mention race. But what happens as a result of this is that children pick up norms and rules at an unconscious level, and because they're never discussed explicitly, these rules go essentially unchallenged.
And that unconscious level, they're picking it up through what? Television? Through what other people are saying? Through what's going on there?
Yes, just through a host of different mechanisms. I'll give you an example from my own life, which might illustrate the phenomenon. When I was writing the chapter on the biases of very small children, my own daughter turned three. And we would play this game called Doctor, and where, you know, she would examine all her stuffed animals with a stethoscope and so on. And she would insist that I play the role of doctor and she play the role of nurse. And after some days, I suggested we switch roles, and she play doctor and I play nurse. And she was willing to play the doctor, but she was not willing to let me play nurse. And this went on for a couple of weeks until I eventually asked her, well, why is it that I can't play the role of nurse? And it was surprising she could actually articulate an answer. And she said, you know, I've never seen a storybook where a man plays the role of a nurse. And, you know, when she said that, I reflected that I had read her hundreds of stories, probably, of picture books where indeed all the nurses depicted were always women. And you know, the fact that the author of the storybook had made a choice to make the nurse a woman rather than a man was something that I had never thought about. Mm. The fact that I'm reading the story is something that I, you know, the fact that I'm communicating this message to her is something I'd never thought about. The point I'm trying to make is without anyone consciously intending to communicate a stereotype to a child, my three-year-old daughter, you know, had picked up the stereotype that nurses generally or nurses have to be women, that they can't be men. And this is the way our unconscious minds work on a whole host of different domains. Even as we try and teach things to our children consciously, what we're not aware of is that at an unconscious level, they're picking up these huge warehouses of information based on associations they see from everyday life, from television, from picture books, from the things that their parents talk about or the things that their parents don't talk about, from their friends, relatives, and their neighbors.
So did you run right out and buy books that had male nurses and female doctors?
Well, you know, what that encounter helped do for me, I think, is when I try and read picture books to my daughter now, I try and make things that would have been unconscious conscious. And in some ways, that is the central message in my book. I now try and draw attention to the fact that the author of the storybook made a choice to make that nurse a woman. It wasn't something that was inevitable. A couple of weeks ago, I took my daughter into the doctor because she had a fever. And to my great and happy surprise, a male nurse came in and examined my daughter and took her temperature. And then the male nurse left the room, and there was this long moment of silence, and I could sort of see the wheels turning in my daughter's head. And then she said, well, men can be nurses too. And so in some ways, this doesn't mean that the unconscious associations that she has formed in her head go away. You know, the overwhelming force of the cultural message in her unconscious mind is still that nurses are women. But I think what has changed is now there is a conscious counterweight to that in her conscious mind. When her unconscious mind says, well, a nurse has to be a woman, her conscious mind and her unconscious mind can sit down for a chat, and the conscious mind can say, that's not true. As a matter of fact, I was once examined by a nurse who happened to be a man.
Right. Can you tell me, you bring this up in your book, and I don't think I quite get it. How can somebody who is about to be on the national stage, perhaps as a presidential candidate, use the word macaca and not think that it's a bad thing that he said, has no association with it, doesn't think that it's a racist term, just doesn't have a clue.
You're referring, of course, to the famous incident with former Virginia Governor George Allen in
right.
the 2006 Senate race, where he called an Indian American at one of his political rallies Makaka. The event, the incident, as I'm sure your listeners will remember, eventually derailed Allen's Senate campaign and eventually turned over control of the Senate to the Democrats. So after the incident, there was just, you know, a lot of news coverage that suggested that Allen had explicitly racist views and that this, you know, his use of the term Makaka came from his explicit from explicit racism. I try and make an argument in a chapter that in some ways our beliefs that racism is always conscious, that it comes out of the conscious mind, is deeply problematic for a number of different reasons. When you conduct experiments that measure people's unconscious attitudes about race, it turns out that children and adults and elderly people have virtually identical unconscious associations in their minds. What changes between the time you're 3 and 50 and 90 is not so much that your unconscious associations are changing, but that your conscious mind is changing. So by the time my daughter is 23, if I ask her, can a nurse be only a woman, she would automatically say no, because I'm really eliciting an answer at that point from her conscious mind. And at a conscious level, she knows that the stereotype that women have to be nurses, you know, is false, that it's a wrong stereotype. What happens in many situations in life is that there are times when our conscious minds are overwhelmed, that they have too much going on, they're dealing with too many things, and essentially they don't have the ability to censor the unconscious associations in the hidden brain. And it's at times like this that I argue, and I believe this is probably what happened to former Governor George Allen, when he had his conscious mind full dealing with whatever he was dealing with in the course of the political campaign, that the unconscious associations in his mind between people of color and what is clearly a racist term surfaced. Now, the point that I was trying to make in this incident is not to let Governor George Allen off the hook. My point really is that the conventional way we have of dealing with racism is to call people out on it and to say, look, you're being racist, you're acting in racist ways.
Yes.
If racism is unconscious, what happens is when these people look inside their hearts, they don't see evidence of racism. They genuinely do not see evidence that they're acting in racist ways. And what this allows them to do is to dismiss the criticism as being unfounded and unfair. When we think about racism or prejudice as being an unconscious phenomenon, it doesn't mean we let people off the hook. But what it does mean is that our strategies to go after this unconscious bias need to be different, because telling people that what they did is wrong, asking people to introspect and to cure them, you know, to cure their racist attitudes doesn't work, because by definition, unconscious bias is unconscious.
So you cannot access that kind of unconscious racism through introspection?
I think it's difficult to do, and I think it is the case that, just as in the case of Wendy McNamara, you know, she had no awareness that there was this part of her brain that was, you know, really crucial in her social relationships. There are parts of our brains that make associations between groups of people and certain characteristics over which we have no control. Now, I keep coming back to this point. This does not in any way mean that people who say and do racist things should be let off the hook because they can say, it wasn't me, it was my unconscious mind that made me do it. We are still responsible for our actions and our behavior, regardless
yes.
of whether the motivations for those actions and behavior came from our conscious and unconscious mind.
Yes. So how do we get at that? How would George Allen get at that? Because if he's going to, well, he's about had it right now, but if he were to decide, ooh, I got something going on here I'm not very aware of and I want to change my behavior so that it will never happen again, how would he do that?
So I think the first step to do is to recognize that this term didn't come from nowhere. So Allen basically made the argument that the term simply popped into his mind. He'd actually never heard the
right.
term before. That there was nothing racist about it, that he, you know, he had absolutely no idea where it came from. If you were to buy the thesis, on the other hand, that there is such a thing as the unconscious mind and that it influences us, the first thing to do is to recognize that it exists and that even when we feel we are acting in fair-minded, tolerant, generous ways, in reality we may not. Not because our conscious minds are, you know, don't believe that all people are created equal, but because our unconscious minds believe that all people are not created, you know, are created equal. And I think what you can do at that point is when you recognize that you have this unconscious bias, you could try and find ways to compensate for it. You could have more of the conversations at an explicit and conscious level because you recognize that in these situations, your unconscious mind has a point of view that you don't agree with. One analogy that I often use to think about this is if you think about the conscious mind as being the pilot of the plane and the unconscious mind as being the autopilot function on the plane, there's nothing wrong with having an autopilot, and in fact, it serves usually a very functional purpose. There are many times flying on autopilot is very useful. The problem arises when you're flying on autopilot through a storm, because at that point, you actually want to have conscious control over what's happening. So if I were to advise George Allen, what I would say is the point is not to beat up on yourself or to basically say, I have no responsibility for what I said. The point really is to take responsibility for what you said and to try and say, this could influence me again in the future when I'm making judgments about somebody else, when I'm deciding who to hire for a job or who to fire for a job, what kind of treatment I need to give a patient who walks into my office, how I'm interacting with a student if I'm a professor. So when we acknowledge the reality of the unconscious mind, it doesn't diminish our sense of personal responsibility. If anything, it vastly expands it.
Phone calls for... In just one moment, our guest is the author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. Shankar Vedantam is our guest. He is a national correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post, and from 2009 to 2010, a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guest, starting with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The argument that I'd like to make is that the Republicans use racism because they know it works, and they know it at a conscious level, and they don't have any qualms about using it irregardless of the moral issues. And two examples of this, one is the current Tancredo statements made by Tom Tancredo at the Tea Party convention, where he basically was trying to reinstitute the literacy test for people to vote. He slurred blacks, and he also said that people that couldn't even speak English were voting for Obama, which was a slur on the Latinos. And then, of course, the other example was John McCain, the undercurrent smear campaign in South Carolina, which helped Bush get the nomination, where they basically inferred that he had fathered a black child when in fact he had adopted a child from India. So these people have no problem in using this as a tactic, and yet on the same hand, unfortunately, the Democrats don't use it to retaliate in terms of confronting them about this, which they could have done. They should be putting something on BET and the Spanish networks as we speak, because they ought to call them out on this racism, but they're not doing it.
Shankar?
Jim, that's a really fascinating question. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book looking at the effects of unconscious bias in politics, and specifically at the issue of the use of race in political messages in the context of the 2008 presidential election. I present some very controversial data in that chapter, which shows that there is actually a correlation between unconscious racial bias and political views, that while it is the case that both Democrats and Republicans, and in fact both whites and blacks on average, show an anti-black racial bias across the United States, it is the case that on average areas of the country which show the greatest levels of racial bias are most likely to vote conservative, and areas of the country that have the least racial bias are likely to vote for Democrats. The question that you're raising about the use of these of racist or racial appeals in election campaigns turns out to be surprisingly complicated. The problem is not just with people who make explicit links to race. The real problem actually lies with people who are making unconscious links to race. In some ways, it's easy to call out the people who are making the explicitly racial comments, the people who are explicitly saying that other groups are inferior. And in some ways, it's easy to call them out and sort of see where the flaws lie in those arguments. What's much more insidious is when political campaigns play on our unconscious racial fears And because those fears are unconscious, we don't realize that we are being manipulated. In this particular chapter of the book, I talk about how a secret series of experiments were conducted by psychologists during the 2008 presidential campaign, asking whether it was possible to effectively de-bias people on the issue of racial prejudice, given that Barack Obama was running for president, in the course of a political campaign. And they discovered some really fascinating things. The most interesting thing I think they found was that the conventional way we think of to disable race, which is to call people out on it, what you're just suggesting, you know, to go on BET or a television station and say, look, they're saying these racist things, turns out to be relatively ineffective in combating unconscious prejudice. And it goes back to what we were talking about a second ago when we were talking about George Allen, because when prejudice is unconscious, calling attention to it often doesn't work because when people look in their hearts, they don't see evidence of prejudice. What turned out to be much more effective was to do what the Obama campaign actually did. I don't know whether they did this consciously or unconsciously, but if you look at how the Obama campaign, you know, handled the question of race, Barack and Michelle Obama and the rest of their team almost never drew attention to it. They never cried foul, even though, you know, millions of people said that they would, explicitly said that they would never vote for a black man. What the campaign did, by contrast, was to consciously call people to their better angels, to talk about how America in many ways has come to transcend race and to, you know, get people to behave in ways that lived up to their highest ideals rather than follow their unconscious minds.
Don't you think, Shankar, that they had to do it consciously because they were embarking on a very historic campaign and it was painfully obvious that race was going to be there when you turned around almost every corner?
Yes, but the point that I think I'm trying to make is that I think that they handled the issue of race largely at an unconscious level and not at a conscious level. In contrast to many other black politicians who've often explicitly come forward and say, listen, I'm being treated in racist ways. You know, Barack and Michelle Obama never did that. They never said, even when, you know, people told pollsters, I will not vote for a black man because he is black, they never came out and said, look, this is unfair. We are being treated unfairly. And I think this is what the research on unconscious bias is showing, which is that the way to go after unconscious prejudice is often not head on and head first. Because mm-hmm. when you do that, all that it provokes is resistance and defensiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't actually promote change in people's hearts. Rather, when you go sort of the side route and you sort of tell people, look, let's aspire to be better than we are, you give people a way to navigate around their unconscious biases, if you will. Now, there are certain problematic aspects of this, and I discuss this at length in the chapter, but suffice it to say for this forum that I think the conventional way to call people out on their errors often turns out to be ineffective, and you can see this in real life on a whole number of different issues. For all of the evidence that the Obama campaign provided, for example, documenting that he was a U.S. citizen and was born in the United States, millions of people believed during the campaign, and probably still believe today, that Obama was not a U.S. citizen and he was not born in the United States. So in some ways, presenting the refutation at a conscious level, even though we think it should work, turns out to be surprisingly ineffective on a whole number of different issues.
So what is the best way? Let's just take that particular issue, because millions of people still believe that he's not a citizen of the United States, which is crazy as far as I'm concerned, but people adhere to that belief.
Yes.
I would like to believe there's a way to get to the conscious mind or the unconscious mind or whatever heck is operating here
right.
to say, this is nuts. You're just get this idea out of your head because it's just not true.
Right. But I think, Kathleen, the underlying assumption in your question is that people make these decisions consciously and deliberately, that we carefully weigh the evidence and then come to our conclusions.
Yes. When
in reality, in much of our lives, and this is true for both Republicans and Democrats, we often reach our conclusions and then find evidence to back up where we stand. And we find this across the world. I mean, there are millions of people who don't believe the Holocaust took place. And we've spent 60 years presenting them with photographic evidence and other kinds of very clear evidence telling them, look, the Holocaust did take place, and it doesn't change their minds. And it doesn't change their minds not because the evidence that we're presenting is insufficient, but because there's an internal motivation for them not to believe in that evidence. So I think what you're really getting at here is that human thought is motivated by what we want to see happen. In other words, our motivations influence how we are processing the information that's provided to us. During the 2008 election, psychologists conducted another experiment that's really remarkable, and let me mention it for a quick second.
Sure.
They measured people's unconscious beliefs about whether Obama was American or not. Not their conscious views, but their unconscious views. And they found remarkably that both among many Democrats, as well as in the general election among Republicans and Democrats, large numbers of Americans unconsciously thought Obama was less American than was Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister. In other words, at an unconscious level, they believed that a white man was more American than a black man. Now, what makes this surprising and absurd is that if you ask people at a conscious level which of Obama or Blair is American, they would look at you funny. They would sort of say, what a ridiculous question. Of course, Tony Blair is the British Prime Minister and Barack Obama is American, and this would be true for many Democrats. But it turned out this unconscious association of non-whiteness with non-Americanness was a powerful predictor of whether people did not vote for Barack Obama, both in the Democratic primary and in the general election.
Mm.
In other words, even if people's policy views lined up perfectly with that of Barack Obama, if they had these unconscious associations that he was less American, somehow not, quote-unquote, one of us, they were much less likely to vote for him, even though at an explicit level, you know, their policy views lined up perfectly with the Obama campaign.
Yeah. Well, I tend to, and maybe this is just too narrow, to think of the people who feel that way and people who deny the Holocaust as being incredibly stupid. And I'm wondering, because those kinds of thoughts can be very dangerous for the world, there's got to be some way for people to be guided by the truth, be it their hidden brain or their regular brain, but you can't just let that pass.
I'm completely with you, Kathleen. I don't think you can let these pass, and I think these views are insidious and they carry enormous, you know, moral and political consequence in our world. But I think the conventional way we have to go after these things, which is to confront this and sort of say, look, this is stupid. Look, this is absurd. Look, there's data to, you know, contradict your views, turns out to be ineffective. So at the level of saying what works and what doesn't work, the conscious approach, which is the belief that good information will drive bad information out of circulation, turns out to be surprisingly ineffective. There was research conducted by psychologists, again, which found remarkably that in some ways when people believe something very strongly, presenting them with contrary views not only doesn't change their minds, but in some ways can unintentionally strengthen their pre-existing beliefs, can strengthen the power of misinformation. And again, it speaks to this whole idea that we really have two minds within our heads. And at a conscious level, what you say should be absolutely true, that good information should drive bad information out of circulation. At an unconscious level, however, this turns out not to be the case, that good information can amplify bad information because good information can be threatening to our pre-existing views. And if our motivations are unconsciously motivated to disbelieve the information coming in, we will not only reject the good information, but we will find ways to shore up the bad information in our unconscious minds.
Let's go. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Stephen from Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi. This is a fascinating discussion. I had an experience that's a little bit unique. As a journalist, I was sent to Havana, Cuba in the late 80s, and I went there thinking I was obviously not a racist person, and, you know, that I'd spent years, you know, the old thing of some of my best friends are, fill in the blank. And when I was in Cuba, I realized that Castro had made racism illegal. There are laws against it. Cuban people cannot do any discrimination by race because it's made up of Spanish conquistadors, African slaves, and Chinese indentured servants. They're all blended together when you're there. There are people who look a little Chinese and a little, you know, and all of a sudden your mind boggles. You realize, I can't decide. I'm talking to a black person now. I can't. And for the first time, I realized that I had been making that subconscious notation every time I talked to an Asian person or whatever. And I realized it's all BS. It's not real. I'm doing this. But it doesn't mean anything, because I'd be with people who were all shades and flavors, and they'd all be mixed together in social events and talking to each other, and nobody was thinking about anything. Racism, for the first time in my life, completely vanished when I was in Havana, Cuba.
Huh.
And I think that here in America, we have a sub kind of a subtextual racism going on, because in one sense, African-American people culturally have created a kind of a wall around themselves with a certain talk, style, mannerisms. I heard Barack Obama speak to a black audience in a voice that I had never heard Barack Obama speak generally in public with. And I realized, oh my gosh, you know, he can just kind of shift into this black identity and out of it again. And we here have a false perception that there is a difference because it's created in our culture. It's like a social club. You know, you can't be in my club because you're not black.
And all right.
It's something I think that you don't realize until you finally break through.
Shankar.
So you're raising a whole bunch of really fascinating questions here, Stephen. Thank you so much for the call. I think you're right that in many ways our preconceptions about race are wrong, that these are in some ways socially constructed worlds, and in that sense that they're, you know, they're not real in the sense that they don't have, you know, they don't have to be the way they actually are. These are social constructions. But I would actually disagree with a couple of things that you said. I would disagree with the sense that in some ways the laws are a way to sort of, you can legislate racism out of existence. Because in some ways, we've tried to do that for a very long time in the United States. And again, the use of the law to legislate racism away, to legislate hate crimes away, turns out to not be very effective in terms of reducing racism or reducing hate crimes. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying for a moment that the civil rights movement wasn't valuable, that, you know, enfranchising large numbers of African Americans wasn't a huge step forward. These were very important things to do. What I am saying, though, is that these are not sufficient steps to do, because at a certain level, you can't tell people who don't recognize that they have unconscious bias not to be biased, because they don't feel like they're acting in biased ways. The other thing that I think is problematic in what you're saying is that I think people believe that the ideal society would be a colorblind society where we do not recognize race, where we do not notice gender, where we do not notice sexual orientation, and so on and so forth. Now, I think this is a fundamentally flawed concept, because I believe at an unconscious level, our unconscious minds will always notice these things. Regardless of whether our conscious minds think that this is a good thing to notice or a bad thing to notice, our unconscious minds will notice these things, because that's how our unconscious minds are designed. They're designed to take note of things that we have found in the past have social valence. And so in some ways, the goal, I don't think, is a colorblind society. The goal is not to say, I don't notice that you're a white person, or I don't notice that you're a woman, or I don't notice that you're a transgendered person, but to say, what are the associations that I have in my unconscious mind when I see a transgendered person, or a black person, or a gay person, that might influence how I'm interacting with this person when I'm hiring them for a job, or when I'm deciding whether to give them a promotion, or whether I'm deciding how much of a salary to pay them. So in some ways, the goal, I don't think, is to eliminate race altogether from our minds, because worthy as that aspiration may be, it's not an aspiration that's rooted in reality.
Mm. But precluding that, you have to have associations with people of all colors and sexual preferences, et cetera, in order for you to make an accurate assessment of that, right? You can't have a society, and we had to do it by law, so yes, that people would be able to interact with each other.
Yes, no, I completely agree. I think the law was a crucial and essential first step, but I don't think the law should be seen as a final step. One of the chapters in my book, for example, talks about unconscious biases in the criminal justice system, and it shows how perfectly well-intentioned jurors and judges and prosecutors are far more likely to seek and award the death penalty to African-American defendants who are darker-skinned than to African-American defendants who are lighter-skinned. So this is not an interracial bias, it's an intraracial bias. So even within a single racial group, our unconscious minds make associations that associate certain people with actions that seem worse to us than the actions of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to legislate this out of existence, because the law does not have the nuance and the sophistication to deal with the ways our unconscious minds categorize and create our worlds.
Thanks very much, Stephen, for your call. We need to pause for a moment. There's so much more in the book, too. We could talk about this issue of race, obviously, for the whole hour. But I do want to move at some point here to the 88th and 89th floor of the World Trade Center and why almost everybody from one of those floors made it out safely and from the other floor did not. What did the hidden brain have to do with that? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Shankar Vedantam. His book is The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He's a national columnist and correspondent for The Washington Post, and this year a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Let's talk about 88, 89th floors of the World Trade Center, please, and how hidden brain activity may have saved many people and resulted in the deaths of many people.
Sure. One of the things that I'm trying to show in the book is that the effects of the unconscious mind are ubiquitous, and they spread over many different dimensions of our lives. So prejudice is an important dimension of the unconscious mind, but it's only a special case of what's actually a much larger phenomenon. The unconscious is with us constantly in our lives, and one of the chapters in my book looks at the effects of unconscious bias during disaster situations, during unfolding disasters. I follow what happened at a financial trading firm that was spread high in the South Tower of the World Trade Center on the 88th and 89th floor on the morning of September 11, 2001. The South Tower, as your listeners will remember, was the second tower to be hit that awful morning. And between the time the first plane hit the North Tower and the second plane hit the South Tower, there was a 16-minute window. Within that window, everyone who escaped the upper floors of the South Tower within those first 16 minutes survived, but nearly everyone who remained in the South Tower within that 16-minute window perished. And I look at why it is that after the rubble had cleared, people found that nearly everyone on the 88th floor at this financial trading firm had exited the building and survived, and nearly everyone on the 89th floor had stayed behind in their desks and perished. The central idea in this chapter is that human beings are powerfully influenced by those around them in everyday settings. Even right now, regardless of whether you're driving in your car or you're in a business meeting or you're listening at home to the radio with friends, but this is especially true in disaster situations, that our sense of autonomy, our sense of being able to act intentionally and autonomously is severely constrained in moments of great fear or panic or uncertainty. And we turn over many of the controls, many of our judgments and decisions to the group rather than make them autonomously and individually. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that autonomous individual action is always superior to, you know, following what the group does. In some ways, I think the terms, you know, herd mentality or group behavior have gotten a bad name because in many ways, human beings are designed to be intensely social creatures. It's what makes us human. But it is the case that in disaster situations, the ability of the disaster to deprive us of our autonomy can cause people to sometimes act against what they know is in their own best interest.
Hmm. But it was also, this is where I miss it, because of one person's autonomy that floor got out because he said, get out of here. And then this guy went up to the other floors to tell other people to get out. And because of his heroic action, and he sacrificed his life, didn't that have a lot to do with that as well?
It did have a lot to do with that. What I try and show is that within that 16-minute window, the people in the South Tower really weren't quite sure what to do. It wasn't clear in those first 16 minutes that these were terrorist attacks on the United States. People believe that a plane may have hit the North Tower by accident. The emerging school of thought in disaster management was that if your own building is intact, it's better not to run out and get hit by falling debris. The people in the South Tower building officials made announcements that people could stay behind in the South Tower at their desks if they wished. And at the same time, there were many people who said, look, something terrible has happened outside. We should go. And on the 88th floor, there was one man, J.J. Aguiar, at this financial trading firm, who urged the people around him to get up and leave. What I try and show, though, is that on both floors, there were these powerful forces that, on the one hand, caused people, you know, were telling people, get up and leave, and there were also powerful forces that were telling people, no, stay behind at your desks, that's where you're going to be safer. And what I try and show in both cases, it's not so much that one group made the right decision and one group made the wrong decision. I mean, we know that that's the case in hindsight, But what's really the phenomenon that I'm trying to get at is that both groups essentially reached the same decision. Everyone on one floor reached one decision. Everyone on the other floor reached the other decision. It wasn't as if individuals were thinking individually and autonomously about what to do. It was the group as a whole that was really making the decision about whether to jump up and leave or whether to stay behind at their desk.
Margie from Franklin, hi.
Hi. This is amazing. I'm just really, really enjoying this program. I don't know if I'm taking it to a wrong angle, but does this unconscious, this stuff that you're talking about, does it explain a little bit about what's going on with women that stay in domestic abuse situations when all the evidence is pointing to one thing and families telling them and they keep going back?
That's a really great question, Margie. Thank you so much for the call. I do have a chapter in The Hidden Brain that looks specifically at the issue of gender and the unconscious ways our perceptions of gender influence how we elect leaders and how we evaluate coworkers and colleagues and employees. I have not specifically looked at the question of unconscious bias when it comes to domestic abuse, but I think it is fair to say that in personal relationships, the unconscious does play a very powerful role for both good and for bad. In fact, I was reading something that was on the humorous side yesterday, which shows that when people are in love, they idealize their partners and imagine their partners to be better than they really are. And in fact, they imagine their partners to be better than the partners themselves think they are. And this is a bias. So in other words, people in love don't see their partners very clearly. But it turns out that it's a very useful bias to have, that it prompts people to have better relationships, healthier relationships, and to be happier in their relationships and in their marriages. And so in some ways, it's a healthy bias. What you're describing is sort of the flip side of that, which is people in profoundly unhealthy, you know, unsatisfying and dangerous relationships being unable to leave, you know, much in the way the cigarette addict isn't able to throw away his or her cigarettes.
And thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Greg from, where are you from, Greg?
From Manchez.
Manchez. Go ahead, Greg.
This is a fascinating subject for me, and I wondered whether your guest has and I might have missed this because I missed part of the program, but has a guess on how critical thinking basically serves to override the unconscious brain. And basically, I've been hearing some political talk, and one of your earlier callers mentioned the Republicans. Well, I'm not a partisan and never have been, except that I'm a pretty progressive individual and I'm an equal opportunity critic of both parties. And I noticed that when the Tea Party movement started taking shape, that there was a prominent Republican, former Congressman Dick Armey, who was who had something to do with all of that. And my feeling is that the Tea Party movement was is basically there to sort of create havoc for the current administration, and it includes a lot of groups that no one really wants to own, like white supremacists and neo-Nazis had a presence there. And I wondered if that presence isn't what initially the Tea Party movement got a whole lot of media coverage, and I don't know where the left-leaning media myth stands now, but it seems to be a farce considering media consolidation. And they were covering the Tea Party movement quite strongly in the beginning, and then a few reports about the basically hate groups that were in sometimes present seemed to diminish all that. But how do people in such a movement get critical thinking to counteract the effects of their conditioning, their unconscious conditioning?
All right, let's go, let's stop with that because we're running out of time. It's a good question. Shankar?
Yeah, lots of great questions there, Greg. Thanks so much. It would take too long to sort of detail the many ways, I think, in which unconscious bias influences our political judgments. I spend a good 10 or 12,000 words in the book talking about this in the chapter called Disarming the Bomb, which looks at the many, many complex ways in which people are influenced by messages created by political operatives that are really quite skillful now at manipulating people at an unconscious level to vote for this candidate or against a candidate. But to the broader point that you're raising, I'm completely with you, which is that I think ultimately it is critical thinking that is our only safeguard against these biases. And it is true that I think when we think about our political opponents, this is true for both people on the left and the right, we invariably, you know, wish to cure our opponents of their biases and to encourage them to practice critical thinking. And I think this is fundamentally, it comes from a good place. The intention is good. But in many ways, the person whom we, each of us, has the most ability to help and to help address when it comes to unconscious biases is ourselves. And I've tried to take that away from myself as I've written and reported this book. I've tried to ask myself when I feel very sure about a political candidate or a political party, you know, to ask myself, well, is it possible that some of this view is shaped not by my conscious thinking and beliefs, but by unconscious associations, by unconscious bias? And it doesn't necessarily mean I have to change my allegiances or discard my beliefs, but I think what it has allowed me to do is to adopt a little bit more humility about my views.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Shankar, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Interesting conversation. The book is The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. Shankar Vedantam, our guest. Thanks to Erica Janik for producing this hour, and to Chrissy Peace, who ends our first week with us. Thanks, Chrissy. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. Be with you again on Monday.